Welcome to the K-12 Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder, your daily podcast of the top education headlines from across the web. And now, here are your hosts, Mike and Susie.
Good morning. There's your bell, and welcome to the K-12 Breakdown for March 21st. I am Mike Bronder, and I'm here with my co-host, Susie Brooks. We're going to read through the top headlines that matter to K-12 leaders. Today, we're going to go in depth on stories in Mississippi. The fight over school funding could lead to some big bucks for schools. Another story from Missouri we're going to dive into around discussion about moving to a four-day week to help attract teachers. There is a HVAC pre-apprenticeships that are improving the skilled worker pipeline that we'll read about. And Susie Brooks is going to dive into why grading systems that are touted as more equitable are so hard to implement. And to kick us off with today's headlines, here's Susie Brooks.
Good morning, Michael. I'm so glad to be here on this chilly, sunny spring morning. Some of the stories that are coming across our newsfeed this morning are, let's see, the first one is coming at us from Kara Arundel from K-12 Dive, and it's special education advocates warn of chilling effects from anti-DEI efforts. A researcher at Heritage Foundation, however, says DEI rollbacks would benefit the special education community. Also, we have stress leading is the leading cause why Black and Latino students leave college. And that's coming from the 74, written by Joshua Bay. A new report has found that Black and Latino students continue to be more likely than their white peers to leave post-secondary education, even as college enrollment has slowly increased since the pandemic. The report from Gallup and the Lumina Foundation surveyed more than 14,000 respondents in the fall of 2023. So if you want to check that out, you can head over to k12leaders.com/breakdown. But I'm going to dive into a story that I previewed yesterday that was posted on the 74, entitled "Why is a grading system touted as more accurate and equitable so hard to implement?" So we have kind of broken that down into a shorter story because it is a long one, and it's posted here on our K-12 Leaders site. So it's written by Amanda Gettled. And it says, as schools across the country work to address pandemic learning gaps, a growing number are turning to alternative grading system called standards-based grading. The goal is to more accurately communicate what students have learned and provide a clearer picture to parents and colleges. But as the 74 reports, the implementation has been messy, with many schools and consultants getting it wrong. When education researcher Thomas Guskey was a middle school math teacher decades ago, he had an eye-opening interaction with one of his top students. An eighth grader revealed that she had calculated exactly what test score she needed to get an A in the class, down to the 10th decimal place. "I only need a 50.2 to get an A," she told Guskey nonchalantly. "I don't need to study for a 50.2, Guskey thought. Wow, what have I done? For this student and for so many others, school has devolved into a numbers game about scoring well rather than a passion for true learning. Traditional grading systems conflate academic mastery with factors like behavior, effort, attendance, homework completion, and they muddy the meaning of the single grade. Standards-based grading aims to pull these elements apart, reporting academics, work habits, and other factors individually on a kind of dashboard, Laura Link, an associate professor of teaching and leadership at the University of North Dakota, says. This segregated reporting provides a much clearer insight. By giving this kind of multi-metric dashboard of information, she explained, it helps parents, colleges, trade schools, military recruiters, and others have a deeper understanding of what kind of students they're looking at, their academic strengths, but also those habits and behaviors that enable student learning. Link has been working with schools like Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, to implement the model, which separates out academic grades on a 0-4 scale from behavioral factors like attendance, work ethic, and responsibility. But the nationwide push to adopt standards-based grading has vastly outpaced teacher training. Thomas Guskey, now professor emeritus of education at the University of Kentucky, warns that lack of preparation is providing disastrous. So many districts are getting into this and they're failing miserably, he said. Schools are jumping into this without a clear notion of what they're doing and what prerequisites are being standards based. And then when problems arise, they have no recourse except to abandon it completely. Link and Guskey warn that there is no consensus on what standards-based grading even means, with a slew of grading book authors, consultants, and self-proclaimed experts providing inconsistent, often unproven advice that derails implementation efforts. One particularly controversial piece of advice that students should get unlimited opportunities to redo assignments until they've mastered the content, Link says that goes too far. This is where a lot of non-academic proponents encourage that standards-based grading means that you give as many retakes as it takes for mastery. Not true. That's an assessment issue, not a grading issue. One New York City parent, Talia Matz, is concerned that her son's high school has taken retakes and other elements of standards-based grading to an extreme. At the School of the Future High School in Manhattan, she said, meaningless assignments, endless redos, and no consequences for missed deadlines, and conversations of standards-based grades back to percentages have undermined academic motivation. It doesn't seem like there's any love of learning, Matz lamented. It's just kind of get it done and move on. She worries her son will be unprepared for college expectations around self-directed study. But some districts have had much more success taking a phased, thoughtful approach to standards-based grading implementation and teacher training. In the Grandview District near Kansas City, Superintendent Kenny Rodriguez said that it has been a multi-process of gradual rollouts. Our challenge is, nationally, we still have a system that's so entrenched and based upon our traditional letter grades, Rodriguez said. And that system has been around for so long and never was designed to do what we're now trying to get it to do. Despite the bumps, standards-based grading proponents insist that the major overhaul is worthwhile to provide a clearer window into the students' learning versus just piling up points and percentages. Link says it's a long road, but a critical one. This is not something that we're going to fix in just a year or 2 years. It will have to be an extended period of time of training, of implementation challenges, of getting the community buy-in. But it's so important for us to get it right, ultimately. Matt Townsley, an assistant professor of educational leadership at the University of Northern Iowa, agrees standards-based grading corrects for equity issues baked in traditional grades. If we award points for assignments completed outside of class, called homework, we can imagine scenarios where some families are more privileged in their ability to complete that work, with things like quiet study spaces, tutors, parents able to help. So in that way, we may be grading for access to resources rather than learning. While a handful of schools were early standards-based grading adopters, post-pandemic interest appears to be surging, according to Kathy Vatterott, who wrote the book Rethinking Grading, Meaningful Assessment for Standards-Based Learning. After we got through COVID, all of a sudden, I started getting offers to come and speak to people about standards-based grading, said Vatterott, a professor emeritus, and I don't know if I'm saying that right, of education at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. There seems to be a new momentum building nationally. Critics argue the model is too complex, relies too heavily on teacher judgment, and eliminates helpful accountability measures like class rank and GPA calculations. But for proponents, standards-based grading is realigning classroom grading with its original intent to uphold high academic standards and provide meaningful feedback to students and families. I know that's a long one. Thank you for hanging in there on that one, Michael. But standards-based grading is definitely, they've explained it pretty well in here, just the fact that it's a very hard concept to teach to teachers, to students, and to families, and to move away from that traditional, you know, A, B, C, D, F grading system, for them to understand what those numbers represent and what is, you know, meeting the standard and approaching the standard or not yet meeting the standard. It's a whole new way of thinking. And I agree also that it's very hard to do in the higher grades, but it can be very valuable.
It sure can, Susie. And I speak with schools all the time who are looking into standards-based grading or trying to understand how to make the transition. Sometimes there's a parallel grading system where they keep traditional grades while they try to introduce standards-based gradings. And I think that the article touches on the right, you know, on the right key factor, is that there is no one definition of the format. So it's really hard to implement something new every time, right?
Right. So, yep. And it takes time.
It takes time. But it seems to have its benefits as well. And thank you so much for sharing that story.
You're welcome.
Let's see. So in Chicago, the lawmakers are challenging the school board's choice policy the lawmakers challenged the Chicago school board's choice policy and plans to remove school resource officers. Illinois state lawmakers filed two bills last week aimed at reversing the Chicago Board of Education's decision to rethink school choice policies and remove school resource officers from campus. The bill's focus on board moves that have drawn both support and sharp pushback. You can read more about that by Rima Amin and Samantha Smiley on the 74. We have links here on the breakdown. Let's see, Kara Arundel, again from K-12 Dive, explores broad scientific concepts that could build teachers' confidence and deepen students' foundational learning in early learning. And that's by bringing joy and learning to preschoolers through science lessons. More questions from K-12 Dive by Lauren Barak. When teaching entrepreneurship, where should educators start? Asking students to find opportunities to identify and solve problems that interest them is the best entry point, says one nonprofit leader. And you can read that whole story on the K-12 Dive by Lauren Barak. And let's see, there are four new education books that should be on your reading list. Matt Zelaznik from District Administration dives into those. To save some time on the whole "what book should I read next" part of the equation, District Administration is regularly scouring the latest releases to bring you their most well-informed recommendations. They have four of those in this article by Matt Zelaznik on District Administration. And let's see, we're going to take a read now about the fight over school funding in Mississippi. And this was originally published in Mississippi Today by Bobby Harrison. A battle is brewing in the Mississippi legislature over education funding. A good old game of one-upsmanship could break out between the House and Senate over which chamber is going to commit to more education funding. That would be welcome news for educators who, like everyone else, have been beset by inflation and higher costs for their schools. The House wants to rewrite the Mississippi Adequate Education Program, which is the objective formula that determines the amount of state funds needed to provide the basics to operate an adequate school district. The House plan has many features supported by public education advocates, but many of those advocates are concerned that the rewrite does not include an objective formula, but instead depends on a committee of education professionals to make recommendations to the legislature on the amount of money needed. The House passed an appropriation bill to pump an additional $250 million into K-12 education, perhaps in an effort to garner support for the rewrite. The Senate wants to make changes to the adequate education program but maintain the objective formula. With the Senate changes to MAEP, it will take about $210 million more than appropriated by the 2023 legislature to fully fund the formula, and Senate leaders have committed to doing that. If MAEP is fully funded this session, it would be the first time since 2007 and only the second time since it was fully enacted in 2003. The bottom line is that under the worst case scenario, K-12 education should receive an additional $210 million under the early Senate plan. If it should be pointed out that the Senate has not actually taken up its budget for education like the House has. So, presumably, the Senate could opt to make additional tweaks to the MAEP and increase the amount of money needed to fully fund it. That article is, and more details is linked here on k12leaders.com/breakdown and can be found in Mississippi Today by Bobby Harrison. The great thing about that, Susie, is we have had so many stories over the past couple of weeks about the pressures that districts are under, that states are under with their education budgets. So it's nice to read that states like Mississippi are doing some good work in terms of putting some money behind their educational plans.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Let's see what else we have. There is one in here from Chris Avles from District Administration on someone who has helped launch nearly 1,000 esports programs. He's seen how they draw students to school and how districts can set up teams at little or no cost. You can find out more on how to use esports to increase attendance and funding. And let's see what else we got. Oh goodness.
There's a lot
Right
in the
over.
news today.
I know, I know. Oh, the Florida lottery has transferred 2.45 billion to K-12 education in 2023. Late January, the AG released the financial audit of the Florida lottery so that they've transferred over quite a bit of money. It'll be fun to trace where that goes. That came out of Yahoo search today by K-12 Education. And oh, and then I have one that I'm going to go in on. Where is it? And that one is coming out of K-12 Dive as well. Another favorite of mine. I tend to go to certain resources. I don't know what it is about that. It is written by Nish Amarnath, and it's about HVAC is a pre-apprenticeship program aiming to improve skilled worker pipeline. The Pryor High School Innovation Center in Oklahoma is providing hands-on training that includes repairing and maintaining the school's HVAC systems. The Pryor High School Innovation Center in Pryor, Oklahoma is tapping Interplay Learning's training platform to run its new HVAC pre-apprenticeship program, according to a March 12th news release. Participating high school seniors will take a semester of online courses, in-person training with an HVAC instructor, and daily internship hours with the school's maintenance department. The initiative will help students collect U.S. Department of Labor approved apprenticeship hours and prepare them to take OSHA 10 and EPA 608 exams to obtain industry recognized certifications, Interplay said. After graduating, students can retain access to course materials and obtain personalized referrals to entry level positions with local businesses, including the program's sponsors, RAE Corp and Mid-America Industrial Park. The facilities management industry has been grappling with a shortage of skilled labor amid an aging workforce, early retirements, and a scarcity of young talent, according to a report from the JL Technologies. Against that backdrop, apprenticeships are gaining momentum as a pathway for directing much-needed talent into crucial industries. Last December, the DOL proposed a rule to modernize regulations for registered apprenticeships through measures that include promoting pre-apprenticeship programs and making occupational skills and training more portable. The HVAC pre-apprenticeship program at Pryor High School Innovation Center is designed to take students from zero industry skills to job-ready, Interplay Learning said in the release. It will be offered to two high school seniors each semester. The Austin, Texas-based company platform will be used to provide students with lessons on HVAC fundamentals and safety through online and video courses, hands-on 3D troubleshooting simulations, and virtual reality. These modules will help students practice soft skills and apply theoretical knowledge in real-world scenarios, Interplay Learning noted. Students will also get in-person mentorship from an HVAC instructor and intern with their school's maintenance department for 3 hours every day, learning how to maintain and repair the school's HVAC and electrical systems. This forward-thinking program sets the stage for a new era of early trades education and career exposure, bridging the gap between classroom learning and real-world application, Interplay Learning CEO and founder Doug Donovan said in the release. The program is backed by RAE Corp, which it manufactures commercial and industrial refrigeration and cooling systems, and Mid-America Industrial Park, which seeks to boost area employment by encouraging new businesses and assisting in the growth of existing ones, according to the release. In February, the Biden administration announced nearly $200 million in grants to expand registered apprenticeship programs that focus on high-demand areas such as clean energy, hospitality, and supply chain sectors, including logistics, warehousing, transportation, and manufacturing. What an awesome program. I wish more than two students per semester could do it, but two is an awesome number to start with. What a great opportunity for those students.
Yeah, that sounds great, Susie. Thanks for sharing that excellent story. And you know, we, again, a lot of conversations here on K-12 Leaders about the skilled worker pipeline. So any resources we can share around that, I'm sure are welcome. Let's see. So the, you know, another favorite of ours, Susie, the Learning Network from the New York Times. Today, the word of the day is amorphous. And that word appeared 61 times in the New York Times in the past year. I don't know if anybody here is familiar with the game Semantle. It sort of takes the idea of Wordle and ups it in a couple of ways, but understanding the number of times words are used in the New York Times is a real hack for doing better on Semantle. Also from the Learning Network, they're talking about snacks and drinks and how you can engage in that sort of conversation in your classroom. Also, they talk about keeping a journal and asks their students, what does journaling do for them? Elsewhere, we have 4 proven strategies for teaching AI to girls and anyone by Eric Ofgang in Tech and Learning. 5 ways to keep schools safer with innovative visitor management by Dr. Roderick Sams from eSchool News. How EdTech is transforming bilingual education in the U.S. From eSchool News and Abbas Manji. Millions of students within the United States public school system are non-native English speakers. As this increases, true bilingual education is becoming more vital to equitable support and student success. And then let's see, there is a new youth mental health center opening in Long Island, and you can read about that on eSchool News as well. I think wrapping it up for today, Susie, is going to be a story from Missouri. And this touches on the teacher shortage and some strategies that districts are taking to attract more teachers. Missouri lawmakers want voters to decide whether schools can shift to a 4-day work week. This was originally reported in the Kansas City Star by Anna Sego and Kason Bayless. Large Missouri school districts that want to shift to a 4-day school week and amid a teacher shortage would first have to get approval from voters under a sweeping education package passed by the Missouri Senate last week. The legislation, which now heads to the House, would directly affect the independent school district. The district last year became the largest school system in the state to try a 4-day week in an attempt to attract teachers. It would require school districts in Jackson, St. Louis, Jefferson, and St. Charles counties, or districts that serve more than 30,000 residents, to receive approval from a majority of voters in the district by 2026, in order to keep a 4-day week or to begin offering it. School board members under current state law can decide whether a district shifts to a 4-day week. The proposed legislation would not affect smaller districts in more rural parts of the state. Dale Hurl, the superintendent for independent schools, was critical of the legislation in an interview with the Star this week. 4-day school weeks were never a problem until his district made the switch, he said. It seems like large school districts are very much being singled out, Earl said. How is the fact that large school districts want to do this as a way to attract and retain employees any different than a district that's in a community with under 30,000 students? The provision was included in a massive 167-page education bill that senators passed on a 19-10 vote last week. If approved by the House, it would head to Republican Governor Mike Parson's desk. The legislation would also allow charter schools to operate in Boone County, raise the starting salary for teachers to $40,000 a year, and would expand a tax credit-funded scholarship program for students to attend private or charter schools. The core of the Republican-led bill, filed by Senator Andrew Koenig of Manchester Republican, was widely viewed as a win for school choice advocates who have for years pushed for greater access to non-traditional K-12 education, such as private and religious schools. Senate Democrats voted against the larger package, but were able to negotiate several provisions, including the rules surrounding the four-day week. There is much more over in this discussion going on the Kansas City Star. You can find a link to that on k12leaders.com/breakdown, or go to the Kansas City Star and you can search for this four-day work week story by Anna Sego and Kason Bayless. Susie,
thanks
back
for
to you.
Thanks for sharing. Hashtag long weekend. Oh, and that wraps up another episode of the K-12 Breakdown podcast on K-12 Leaders with Brooks and Bronder. Your engagement and support mean the world to us. So until tomorrow, I'm Susie Brooks.
And I'm Mike Bronder.
Have a great day at school. And remember, just because you can reach it doesn't mean you should touch it. We'll see you tomorrow.